Okay. Good afternoon for most of you. Those of you in, I guess, Eastern or Central time right now, if I have the hours correct. As I mentioned last week, if there is a siren here in Israel, here in Modi'in, I'll need to take a break for a few minutes to get set up, up in our bomb shelter. Please God, that won't happen, but, my life these days is one of those you never know what's going to be. So this past Friday night we had a siren in the beginning of the meal. I'd just taken the soup off the plata, uncovered the soup, and of course inevitably that's when the siren went. But I was very proud of the fact that I managed to put the soup, the cover back on the pot before I went upstairs and into the bomb shelter. So all was okay, but it's good to, the little things in life is what keeps you going these days. So, don't knock good bowl of soup. Okay. So, it's good to be back with you. And, we're going to be focusing today on the issue of dementia and the treatment of dementia. I know from seeing some people here on the, who I know, and I know from consultations that this is certainly an issue which is not theoretical for many people here. Many people, one form or another, have experienced this with themselves, with others, family members. Dementia is very, very, very difficult situation. And what we're going to try to do is to lay out some general guidelines and discuss some of the issues that come up with it. Obviously, as always, I shouldn't say obviously, but as always, I always recommend that when it comes to specific situations, specific questions, you obviously can consult with the rabbi, with the doctor, with others here at Amittai. We're always happy to help as well. And I want to actually utilize today something I wrote to give us a little bit of structure on the Amittai website, which was trying to, I really didn't find elsewhere. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but to try to give a clear summary of the issues that come up with dementia and halacha and sort of just a religious perspective on it. And so we're going to utilize a bit from our website here. I will share that on the screen, of course, but I'm also going to share with you the URL. So that way, for those of you who want to follow along, who want to, sort of follow up afterwards and take a look here, you can find it. I put the URL on the chat. Okay, so dementia is like, fruit, right? In the sense that when you describe fruit, of course, there are different types of fruit and there are different types of dementia. It's a group of symptoms that are associated with a decline in memory, reasoning, or other thinking skills. Cells, which they cells. So usually people think of Alzheimer's when they associate with dementia. Alzheimer's accounts for about 60 to 80% of dementia cases, but of course there are other different types of dementia as well. And of course it's important to keep that in mind when dealing and thinking about these issues. Now, the most important thing I want to stress, and I'm going to stress this now because it's obvious on the one hand and yet so difficult on the other hand, is that the most important religious consideration always, right, when dealing with people with dementia, is to make sure we treat them with dignity and respect, just like we always did. Okay, now that is obviously something which we'd say, of course, right? That is the case. But as those of you know, treating, helping, caring, for people with dementia can be very, very difficult, exhausting, emotionally draining in a lot of different ways. And there's a whole phenomenon, what we sometimes call as caregiver stress. Right, where the stress of taking care of people who have different forms of dementia at different stages of this can be incredibly stressful, can be incredibly difficult on a lot of different levels. And so, one of the things that it's always important to stress from the get-go is the importance of trying to maintain that sense of dignity that you give to them, particularly when it is difficult. And I've become more and more aware, see my own life, but become more and more aware of it since I, you know, we transitioned to Aimatai, about the phenomenon of caregiver stress and how difficult it is. It really, really is difficult. There's nothing to be embarrassed about, but that it is difficult. You know, to make it simple, right? You have someone you've loved, parent, sibling, whatever it might be, for many, many years, and you get to the point where they can't care for themselves and can't recognize you. That is very, very, very emotionally difficult. And so, whether you're in that experience or if you know people with that experience, it is very important to highlight to them and help them to make sure that they're doing important things to relieve some of the caregiver stress. And you can look on websites. You can see things. We have a whole section on our website as well, named Times website. Some of the stuff is sort of the basics, you know, eating well, exercising, things like this. But there are other tips also that are really critical, including making sure you have breaks. Okay. So it is very, very important just to keep that in mind from the get-go, because it is a difficult situation, right? There's no sugarcoating this, as there is no sugarcoating many other issues. Now, one of the things that's super important when you come to questions of dementia is advanced planning. I'm stressing this because I've had a number of cases in the last, I don't know, 3 months, 6 months, where I get calls about consultations in different areas, you know, different people, and they have a family member, a parent, whoever it is, with advanced dementia at this point. And so I start asking them some questions like, well, did you discuss this at an earlier point? And frequently, the answer is no. Right? So you ask, you know, what do you think that they'll be consulted about different types of medical interventions? We'll get into this as we go along, or living conditions and things along these lines. And of course, dementia advances over time. It's a degenerative disease. And when a person is diagnosed with it, so you have a sense, which no one knows fully where the healthcare journey is going to take them, but you do have a sense of where these things are going. And it is very important to be able to discuss some of these issues. And of course, for reasons we all understand, it is super difficult to have those conversations for really a lot of reasons, which I think are understandable, but yet is so important. And so a couple of these consultations, they had cases where, in fact, one of the cases, it was a dual, and this is unfortunately, it's not infrequent, but there's both a case of dementia and also a case of Parkinson's. And so these are two degenerative diseases, each which are miserable in their own right. And when I asked the family members, had you discussed this beforehand? And the answer was no. Again, I'm not judging, I'm not blaming anyone, but there are a number of things which are important to raise, which are difficult to raise, but are really crucial for both the patient, the loved one, for the family to talk about. Okay, so one of these things is financial and legal. Who's making sure that the resources are available? Who's got the proxy? Who has control? Does everyone know where the bank account is, right? Basic things along these lines. Wills, last will and testaments. These are very important things to keep in mind. Division of responsibilities, really, really super crucial. There's a lot to take care of here. Who's taking the trips to the doctor? Who's paying for the bills? Are there different people? Are there family members in different cities? It impacts people in very profound ways. It, you know, it's not easy to talk about this, but it's really not easy to talk about when acute crisis comes up either. Where does the patient want to live? Is it possible for them to remain in their home? For how long? What are the alternatives? What types of assistance required? This really depends a lot also on resources, but also on the country that you're living in. You know, depending on the national healthcare system, whether you're living in America or Canada or Israel or Britain, it's a different world in many different ways. So it's important to be aware of those types of elements as well. And, you know, sort of goal setting as well. I mean, goal setting is a huge part of trying to maintain a sense of meaning, hope, happiness. What is it that you can accomplish in this time and whatever it might be? And if you have those conversations earlier on in the process, you're going to give people an opportunity to have many more meaningful experiences when they still have greater amounts of capacities. So this is really, really important. And when someone has been diagnosed with early onset of dementia, there's still a lot to do. There's a lot to do in life and a lot of meaningful interactions people can have in life. And you want to take advantage of all the time that you have, which you don't always know how long it's going to be, of course. And so not talking about things really isn't helping anyone. You know, we have, as you've seen, our own advanced healthcare directive where we bring up some of those questions, you know, in the TiVote directive that you can find on Amitai's website. There are others out there as well. I can't really stress this enough. Having conversations earlier on is really life affirming and very, very important. Really very, very important. It can bring families together and can prevent a lot of stress later on. Okay, so I really want to stress this. Now, one of the issues that comes up, and this is really a difficult issue in many different realms, but one of the issues that comes up when you're dealing with difficult diagnosis and prognosis, difficult future prospects, is the issue of truth telling. Okay? What do you tell a patient about their condition? So in general, in the world of medicine, things have shifted greatly on this issue. Once upon a time, maybe we'll actually try to dedicate a whole share to this, but once upon a time in medicine, there's a very paternalistic approach to these questions. And the feeling was the doctor knows best, and the doctor who might be a doctor of, cradle to grave, right? Someone's been around for a long time, will sort of manage the amount of information that's given, and very protective sort of strategy. Today, the trend in medical circles is very much of truth disclosure, of truth telling. And there's a number of different reasons for this. One of which is that it's been found that it isn't really always that effective to try to not tell people what's going on. Meaning, you think you're hiding something from someone, but they know how their own body's reacting. It's not always so effective. The other reason why this is important, or why this has changed, excuse me, is that medicine today has changed. And so the chances of you having, of course, it still exists, but frequently people aren't seen by one doctor. Their healthcare is provided by multiple people. It could be in a practice. So you don't have that type of delicate knowledge and relationship that goes on. Also, just practically speaking, it's very difficult to keep information from people. People hear things, overhear things. And finally, and this is probably the most important factor, that it goes to, relates to autonomy. In the general world, there's a very, very strong sense of autonomy, and therefore people don't have autonomy to make decisions if the truth is not being disclosed to them. So that's the general trend in the medical circles. In halachic circles, it sort of followed, I think, a similar type of phenomenon. Initially, meaning when you look at writings from the 60s and 70s, you certainly saw this feeling. Of their diagnosis and prognosis. All right, so that was once upon a time. Oh, 1 second. I just want to make sure. Can you hear me okay? Oh, miss, I don't know what's going on. We have this high speed fiber and everything. Give me a thumbs up if you can hear me now. Okay, all right. I'll just go back here to briefly what I said was that in the old days in the medical world, Nikki, you're in the middle of my screen. So if my connection goes bad, give me a thumbs down. Okay. I won't treat that as if you're giving me a review. Okay. I won't take it personally. So, but you're right smack in the middle of my screen right now. Anyway, so in the old days, it wasn't that long ago, in the 70s and 80s, but before I was born. Well, I was born in 78. But in any case, so it was a time when the rabbis and poskim were very much fearful of revealing the truth. And that trend has changed today. And there are a number of different reasons, but the major factor is twofold. A, it's not really true that knowledge per se causes people to have a bad impact on their physical health. What is true is how things are revealed, how things are told to people can have a really different impact. And so the trend is to follow what's going on in medicine, but to be emphasizing, as we do in the medical world as well, to tell people the truth, but to do, of course, in a sensitive way. And every patient, every scenario has to be different. And, you know, has to be is different, has to be handled in a different way. Recently, we did a video about the story of Dodi Tobin, Zichrono Livracha. It's a beautiful story, of a woman who sort of faced cancer, eyes wide open. And one of these stories we didn't have put in this video, hope to put in another video, is that in general, she had a great relationship with her doctors. But one time, a doctor actually foreign that was being brought in as an expert, said something to her in a sort of a strong way. He was trying to tell her, like, you know, get your affairs in order. Time's running out. And she got that. She knew that. But the way it was said was absolutely devastating for her. It was sort of the worst weekend of the whole experience. And then her other doctors picked her up. So the way things are revealed is very, very important, more than anything. But the other reason why there's a trend towards revelation, to a full disclosure, towards truth telling, is again, this idea that when you tell people the truth, they can figure out in the time that they have with their faculties what they want and how to make it most meaningful. This is a very, very important value, including whether it's the recitation of vidui, fixing affairs, fixing relationships, all sorts of reasons. And so truth telling in general is certainly the trend. However, here it gets complicated because particularly as people get to more advanced stages of dementia and sort of this intermediate stage of dementia, knowledge and information can be absorbed in very confusing ways, very confusing ways. And so it becomes super difficult to know which information you're going to give and how you give it, and if that's going to be harmful or just confusing to the person. There are no rules here in terms of, like, this isn't like a formulaic rule. You're going to have to play this by ear with consultation with the healthcare professionals, social workers, family members, and whatnot. But it's important to recognize that in this circumstance, there's a much greater understanding for outright lying, let alone not revealing the truth. But again, you got to be careful here. There's a really difficult balance here. And so that is something which is difficult to maintain, but it is something to keep in mind. Another big factor, which comes up a lot, has to do with mitzvot observance. Okay, so let's think this through for a moment. A person has early onset of dementia. And in general, you know, we tend to feel that people in that situation are remain chayiv in mitzvot. Now, not that they chayiv in mitzvot, but I mean, the obligated mitzvot observance, but it can be actually very important, right, for people to maintain that sense of regularity, habit, their schedule, their way of life. Very meaningful for people, a lot of different ways. Now, of course, sometimes people will be forgetful and sort of not remember. It could be the day, it could be Shabbat, it could be how to do certain mitzvot, rituals, laws, whatever it might be. And again, this is a skill people have to sometimes learn on the run, but there are ways of, you know, gently reminding people of different factors to make sure that they maintain this observance. And again, the point here is not maintaining people's mitzvah observance. I mean, of course, there is a value of mitzvah observance, but the goal here is to maximize their meaningful living and to give them the benefit of that experience. And so, you know, for example, when this came up, but I don't remember if I was discussing before, after Yom Kippur this year, but someone was telling me a situation where they have a family member and somewhere between early and intermediate stage of dementia. Again, these categories aren't always so clear. And at some point, it was clear to the family members that they sort of lost track of the fact that it was Yom Kippur. They sort of just sort of left, you know, the knowledge of that. And they had to gently remind the person that it was Yom Kippur. And this was very meaningful and very important to them. And they were very happy that they were reminded, even though it was upsetting that they'd forgotten about it. But they're very happy that they had maintained their Yom Kippur observance. So that's one of those types of examples where helping people along, it could be doing the mitzvah to say, it could be tefillin, it could be lighting, you know, Shabbat candles, obviously safety first with all those types of issues. But it's important here to be super sensitive to the fact that we want to try to maintain people's mitzvah observance to the level as possible. At some point, right, things get complicated. And it gets complicated. Again, this is a different experience for different people, but it gets complicated in a lot of different ways. It's not always binary. That's part of the complication here. This notion of saying that people will chai v'mitzvot and suddenly are not chai v'mitzvot. And so the Gemara talks about the idea of someone who's a shota, right? Who's lost or the traditionally is interpreted as insane, but that's not really the connotation here. But it's a good category. It's a relevant category for these purposes. So sometimes the shota will be chai v'mitzvot and sometimes not, depending on their mental capacities, which vary in different circumstances. And the same thing is true when it comes to people with dementia, right? Particularly in sort of the intermediate stage, you could have times when they're more with it and less with it in terms of understanding, or they can be more cognizant of certain areas of law and less cognizant of other areas of law, less capable of areas of law. And so that once again is going to be a bit of a judgment call, with the priority being on keeping things meaningful as much as possible. I stress this because sometimes people are feel very afraid that they're causing their loved one to sin if they don't prevent them from doing X, Y, and Z in Shabbat, or they don't remind them to put on tefillin or to daven or this or whatever else it might be. And so let's just think about this for a moment. Right? Let's just think, what does God, right, want of people? The general answer is when you're chayv mitzvot, to do a mitzvah observance. At some point, though, right, when we're dealing with people in these circumstances or this in between, their chiyuv mitzvah becomes questionable, because the premise of the whole idea of mitzvot is that you're someone who can understand the concept of mitzvot. And in this respect, there's a little bit in halachic literature of a comparison to a katan, to a minor, to a child. I want to be careful with that. I'm not saying that we should treat the same way, for a reason I'll get to momentarily, but the same understanding is just as we don't expect a 7-year-old to do certain things, or we'd allow and wouldn't bother a 7-year-old if they're playing with a muktzah toy on Shabbat, whatever it might be, right? So you might say, okay, in this circumstance, I don't care, right? I'm not going to bother with it. So too, you should be have this in mind with regard to people whose cognizant state is becoming questionable and shaky over time. Certainly, as dementia advances and we get into areas of advanced dementia, so people are frankly putter from mitzvot, right? That is just the category of where they are at this stage. People are putter in mitzvot, and therefore there's no expectation of making them or trying to do them have mitzvot observance. Now that said, there are a couple of things to keep in mind. First of all, even if people become putter in mitzvot, it doesn't mean they're not necessarily going to feel some form of pleasure and enjoyment of mitzvah observance, depending on, again, what they're understanding in the different situation. So I'll give you a simple example. A person who sukkah, right? Is a person chayav to sit in the sukkah with dementia, with advanced dementia? The answer is no, because they're patur from mitzvot. But it doesn't mean, by the way, in the case of sukkah, it's not only that the person with advanced dementia is patur, but the role in sukkah, this is sort of a special role in sukkah, is that their caregivers are also putter. So if you have a situation where parents, whatever it might be, doesn't want to go to the sukkah, wouldn't enjoy it, doesn't want to be outside, and you are helping them feed them or whatever it is, and you're inside, so you're also putter from sitting in the sukkah at that time, right? Because that's a special law of sukkah. But having said that, it could be at points where this is meaningful, where they have cognizance, some level of sitting in the sukkah, and that'd be very meaningful with the family and being outdoors and whatever else it might be. So once again, the focus here isn't on, now then you might ask me, oh, well, did the person mekayim the mitzvah of sukkah if they weren't cognizant of this? And the answer is, I don't know, but it doesn't really matter. Because again, the focus is on trying to maintaining a strongest level of meaningfulness in this time. Someone's, or Len's pointing out on the side here that singing Jewish songs is a good example of meaningful activities. Absolutely, right? Songs and all music in general is super powerful on a lot of different levels, many other things as well. But when it comes to what I'm trying, the point I'm trying to stress here for our purposes right now is, not to be stressed by mitzvah observance per se in this time period. Where it gets a little bit trickier has to do with preventing people from performing prohibitions, from isurim. Okay, so here it gets a little bit trickier. The best example of this relates to Yom Kippur, right? And eating and feeding someone on Yom Kippur. Okay, because we do have a general notion of what's known as sfiach, and there's a general prohibition of assisting or guiding someone in terms of doing a violation of the law. And this is different than lifnei iver. They're related, right? But this is a little bit different. And there's a little bit of a question about where this applies. And probably not surprisingly, the classic case of sfiach comes up with a child. So let's say a child wants to eat meat and, you know, grabs a slice of American cheese and just plops it on their hamburger, right? I'm trying to think of things my kids would do. These days we have all the fake cheese, but you know, we'll be malavet zchut. They throw us the fake cheese and it turned out to be real American cheese or whatever it might be. So are you obligated to take away, the cheeseburger from the child? And here in general, certainly with Yisuri Deraita, but not only, the general inclination is, well, we should, right, take this away, right? We should remove it from the person. And that's partly to have to do with chinuch, and partly has to do with training them in mitzvot observance. And it's partly a sense of just inherently, we don't want Jews to be doing this, these prohibited activities. Well, how does that apply with someone who's equally putter in mitzvot, but there's a fundamental difference here between a child and a person with dementia? A child, we're training them towards mitzvah observance as they mature. And so part of the goal here, part of the idea here, is that you want to distance them from sin, so to speak, because you want to train them in mitzvah observance as they get older towards the age of bar bat mitzvah. When it comes to someone with dementia, that factor really isn't a major factor for us here, right? I mean, right? And in fact, to the contrary, if you want to give the example that I'm mentioning beforehand of eating Yom Kippur, so nutrition, of course, is a really sensitive area, medicine, right? Medical level for those with dementia. And therefore, there is a stress on making sure you're maintaining the nutrition and dietary habits. And so it comes up here with regard to Yom Kippur, where the general rule of thumb is as follows. If the person is able to eat on their own, and they're in a certain situation, you just put the food down, they eat on their own, you don't have to feed them, great. If there's a non-Jewish caregiver who's already there anyway, right, and they can feed them, even better, okay, right, that's great. But if you don't have that situation where they can eat on their own, or drink on their own, and if they need someone, so certainly the priority here is on their health and well-being. And do not worry about the iser of sfiach. And that iser might be relevant in other circumstances, but here we are prioritizing their care. Okay, so that's a general rule of thumb when it comes to mitzvot observance, truth-telling, and in general, advanced healthcare planning. Now, where it gets really sensitive, and here we're going to dedicate much of our time now, has to do with medical interventions in these circumstances. So let's take a step back for a moment, in two different levels. Many times, as people's dementia advances, it is not just dementia as a medical condition that they're dealing with, their comorbidities, there are other health factors going on around as well. And so I'm focused right now, though, in our conversation, just on the element relating to the dementia part. But obviously, as I mentioned earlier, the case of someone with both dementia and Parkinson's or some other comorbidities or advanced heart condition, whatever else it is, you're going to have multiple factors in play. But the questions of which interventions we do or do not do for people with dementia is very sensitive and is a very live debate, particularly in my halachic world, meaning in the world of the advisors that I look to, the poskim I look to in Eimatai. And I'll explain what I mean by that. If you were with us last week, So you recall I mentioned that there's really a great divide in the world of poskim of those who see every moment of life is of infinite value, and therefore the strong default is always to keep people alive, as opposed to those who take quality of life very seriously into consideration. And so if you're in the first camp and you have a situation of advanced dementia, so nonetheless, right, they're alive. They can live that way for very many, many years, in fact. Of course, you're going to do, in general, not even in general, but the strong default is going to be that we're going to do all life-sustaining, life-extending interventions. If, however, right, you take quality of life into consideration, leaving aside dementia for now, then the possibilities of withholding or withdrawing, I can't tell those details right now, different interventions are going to be much more present. Well, where does dementia fit into this conversation? Okay, so let me pull up my screen here for a minute. So first of all, and I want to stress this, I know that many of you here are Canadians. So in Canada, let me make the screen bigger. In Canada, they just came out with the 2022 data statistics of medical assistance in dying. It's used to call, and I still call, euthanasia. And now in 2022, 4.1% of all deaths in Canada happened through euthanasia. That's about 13,500 people died in Canada in 2022 through euthanasia. And I want to, including cases, of course, of dementia, where you do this, the way the law works is you have to do it when you are still able to make that decision. And so people do it early, in early on stage of this. This is our discussion today, right? But that is clearly prohibited in Jewish law. And similarly, with regard to putting out the candle, so to speak, that's the analogy that Chazal give us. That too, of doing the final act, is deemed problematic. There's a notion in halacha, again, of not hastening death, but also of not prolonging dying. Okay? This is where our focus is going to be right now, because we don't want to hasten death, but we also do not want to prolong dying. I want to show you a little bit, a couple of the sources here where this comes from. So you have a Mishnah in Smachot, which tells us the person who is in the dying process, a goses, harehu kechai l'chol davar l'olam. A dying man is regarded as a living entity in respect of all matters in the world. All sorts of halachic implications. And therefore, we do not close the eyes of a dying man. And whoever touches and moves him is a murderer. So this is what I was talking about earlier, the comparison as the lamp is going out. Okay? And the Aruch HaShulchan's formulation here is very important. We saw this last week, where it says, afu bishan arayim shemistah harbeh v'ksisato, v'tov lo mavet. But we might say that death is better for this person and they're suffering. It's forbidden for us to do something to hasten their death. Okay, but what that means, what exactly does it mean to hasten a death, is not so clear. And there's a whole discussion of this. It comes actually originates in Sefer Hasidim. I'm not doing this at length right now. We did this a bit last year also as well. You can see this year online. But the general rule is, right, and you can see this here, we don't cause a person, right, to die faster, hasten their death, but we also don't do anything that to extend their dying process. And the question, of course, becomes is, well, which is which, right? Which one is counts as what? And this is a very difficult discussion in the poskim. Now, why am I stressing this? Because in that conversation, one of the things that comes up is, okay, let's say you have a situation where a person is on a ventilator, right? So is a ventilator considered something where you're just, in this situation, prolonging a person's death? There is a position which says you can remove a ventilator. I'm sorry, one second. What is that noise? I don't know. Okay. Sorry, there's... You hear all sorts of noises and booms and airplanes frequently, but occasionally it's not always clear what it is. Ventilators. So in general, There is a machloket where some poskim feel that removing a ventilator is perfectly appropriate in circumstances when a person is terminally ill. This is the position of Rabbi Chaim David HaLevi. And others feel very much that is not the case, right? Rabbi Chaim David HaLevi felt he was forbidden to keep a person on a ventilator, but Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and others, and this is certainly the strong majority position, feel that you cannot remove a respirator. However, what Rav Moshe does establish is that when a person is not on a respirator, right, not a ventilator, or there's a in between, there's a cyclical moment, right? There's a moment in which they are no longer being this intermittent treatment, and so they are no longer under such treatments, then you can withhold such interaction. Why am I stressing this right now? Because this is a lot longer conversation, but the general rule is that withholding interventions is going to be permissible, and withdrawing interventions is more complicated. Okay? More complicated. Life is every circumstance is a lot more complicated. Okay? And we discussed this at length last year, but I'm just trying to give you a general sense of where this is at. Now, this has major ramifications in end-of-life care treatment, because if you look, you'll see that there are many things, right, which are medical interventions in which you can forego such treatments because they are cyclical interventions, right? They're intermittent. It's not like they are constantly being provided with oxygen as they are on a ventilator. This can include surgery, radiation, vasopressors, which can run out, also dialysis, chemo, and other types of interventions. So this is very, very important as a general rule about withholding, right? Letting nature take its course and allowing the person to die, right? What's known as A and B, allow natural death. Now, where it gets really complicated is the question that we're going to deal with right now. So if I was dealing with ALS, cancer, right, all sorts of other types of difficult degenerative diseases or one form or another, the physical suffering is readily apparent. We all have seen this, right? So the physical suffering is readily apparent. And so the application of these rules in those cases, again, according to the position, which I fully unapologetically adopt, right, which says that quality of life is a matter of great concern in Jewish law. So according to those positions, you understand it becomes much easier to say that we are going to say that some treatments should be withheld, okay, in those circumstances, which is quite a lot of different treatments. In that world, there is still debate about which treatments can be withheld and not withheld, but that is the general feeling that many, many interventions can be withheld. Where does dementia fit into that conversation? Okay. This is a very, very, very difficult question, and people I respect greatly have very, very different opinions on this. So I'd say that one of our members of our Emetai's Halachic Rabbinic Advisory Board is Rabbi Professor Avram Steinberg, Israel Prize Laureate, author of Encyclopedia of Jewish Medical Ethics, very wonderful man and important ethicist. And Professor Steinberg is very much of the feeling that dementia does not fall into the category of physical suffering that would invoke these types of rules that say that we should withhold interventions. Okay. So, when we had the Torah motion, right? In Emetai had this medical ethics conference, JME conference in May, and this discussion came up. And Professor Steinberg said, listen, the family's suffering is horrible. I mean, it's a horrible situation. He's not poo-pooing the difficulty of the situation, but we're not necessarily dealing here with physical suffering. It could be comorbidities, of course, but his feeling is that this is not the same as the types of suffering that would get invoked in other classical cases of terminal illness. And therefore, it is his feeling, and he's following the teachings that he has here from Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and from other poskim, his feeling on this issue is that interventions should continue to go on unless there's some other factor, right? Including, by the way, the insertion of a feeding tube, of a peg, or some other types of artificial nutrition. So this is a big issue, of course, that comes up with people as advanced dementia, how to provide proper nutrition. Many times, there's advantages of just trying to spoon feed them and slowly feeding them, but sometimes that doesn't work. Sometimes they don't have the proper caregivers around. There are a lot of reasons why that sometimes isn't possible. And when that's not possible, so one of the quote unquote solutions or one of the potential interventions might be some form of artificial nutrition, hydration, including the insertion of a PEG tube. And Professor Steinberg is of the feeling that that is, generally speaking, mandated in these circumstances. So if you want to read more about his position on this, so you go back to this page of Emataz here, and you can see the use of a PEG in demented patients, halachic view. We have the PDF here, and you can see, right, his articles here. There's other articles that summarize here. I have an article about the holiday season and whatnot, and you can see that here. And that is his position, and I'd say that is the dominant position in Orthodox poskim, certainly in Israel. That position, however, is not shared by at least two, maybe a third as well, but two prominent poskim in America, Rabbi Herschel Schechter and Rabbi Mordechai Willig, both at Yeshiva University. Schechter and Rav Willig are of the feeling that advanced dementia includes an element of physical suffering, right, and therefore should be included in this category of considerations. And moreover, they feel that certain types of artificial interventions should not be seen as just a natural means that has to be provided. So one of the big debates about, in general, again, we're not getting all the details here of this, but one of the big debates that came up is, even if you think that certain things can be right, withheld, right, not given, right, what about oxygen? What about food? And those types of things, right? These are natural necessity. Let me pull up the screen here. So you can see that Rav Moshe Feinstein, amongst others, felt that artificial oxygen in nutrition is a natural necessity and isn't counted as a medical treatment. And so, because he always felt that this is beneficial, right, and that the absence of this will cause death. And so here the feeling, and this is very much where Professor Steinberg comes from, is the feeling that if you withhold interventions here, particularly natural necessities, right, so you are hastening the death. You're not allowing the disease to bring about the death. And so that for him is the major distinction. Are we allowing the disease to bring about the death? Or on something that we're withholding from the person, and which is a natural necessity, he feels cannot be withheld. Okay. And based on that logic, you might argue and say that, well, when it comes to people with dementia, all forms of interventions that will extend their life, right, barring other circumstances, other complications of the circumstance, should be administered. Now, there are two problems, I should say problems, but there are two questions on this. The first is that it is not clear, and this remains an issue of debate in the medical circles, but there's a lot of studies that are pushing back against the usefulness and utility of forms of artificial nutrition in people with advanced dementia. Tubes, all sorts of things going in and out of people's bodies do not sit well with people who don't understand what's going on to their bodies. And so you could have situations where people are pulling things out, right, where they're even harming themselves. In general, there's concern with general feeding is a difficult situation here, but tubes is not necessarily going to be so helpful. And this really wasn't what it was made for, the pegs, right? I mean, it could be useful, and sometimes it can work, but many times it can be very, very painful inside of them. They can't always express themselves that pain, and they start to pull out the tubes, and it's not simple. So there's one question about whether this is the ideal medical intervention. Right? And many, therefore, try to say as long as possible, we should food speed, ice cream, yoga, whatever it is, right? But try to avoid any form of this type of intervention. Rav Shechter and Rav Willig, however, feel that there's an element of suffering here, and there's no reason to think that in those situations with advanced dementia, right, and with situations, or it could be not just dementia, it could be severe brain damage and other circumstances as well, we should see artificial nutrition and hydration as a form of medical treatment. And since it's a form of medical treatment, it falls into the category then of things with which can be withheld. And so if you look, and you can see this on our website as well, but they have a long article on this, but the article talks about other things as well. But here's some of the things they have to say about that. That the harm of treatment may sometimes outweigh its benefit is true not only about initial treatments, but also about further treatments down the line. For instance, a patient who cannot be weaned from a ventilator is living in anguish, making it through that life has become burdensome for him, and wish to forego life-extending therapies. Invasive procedures such as a trach or a feeding tube placement may be declined. And while a caretaker may not actively interrupt an ongoing treatment, he may passively not apply or renew further treatments, right, in terms of what we called earlier suctioning, right, excuse me, cyclical treatments, including artificial hydration and nutrition. And here, right, they say as follows: if the situation is so unfortunate that reasonable people might not want to continue living in these conditions, the patient has the authority to decline further care. In our opinion, the same principles apply in situations of irreversible lack of cognition, such as advanced dementia or severe brain injury. In these circumstances, the continuation of the Mishnah and Avot is relevant. Better 1 hour of spiritual bliss in the world to come than the entire life of this world. This applies to life in the world where repentance and good deeds are no longer possible, in which case it need not be extended. No new therapies such as oxygen or artificial hydration nutrition need be administered. The primary goal of care should be maintaining the comfort of the patient. This is a controversial psak of Rav Willig and Rav Shechter's. I can tell you, having spoken to many of their Talmidim, their students at YU and other places, not everyone, even in their own circles, agrees with this. But others are sympathetic to this view, and I certainly put it out there as a very legitimate view, which makes sense to me. But let's be careful about when we're applying it. We are applying it in cases of severe advanced dementia, right? We're not talking about intermediate cases when people are going in and out, maybe of certain types of cognitive abilities. And we're talking about situations where the feeling is that there's a form of suffering because of the condition that they are in. Okay. Now, when exactly this kicks in is not always clear, right? And that's why I recommend to people that they always have to contemplate and discuss these issues on case by case level. But let's think this through for a moment, and let's go back to what we started earlier on with advanced planning. Because if you have a moment where you're going to say, okay, mom or dad is really in terrible shape of advanced dementia, maybe at this point we should start thinking about, not necessarily oxygen, let's leave aside oxygen, but withholding all sorts of interventions for other things that might come up, for pneumonia, for various other infections, various other phenomena might happen. Well, are you going to apply this or not? And that's a difficult decision for people to make. And it's a lot better decision. I don't want to say easier, but a decision where people feel more confident about it when they've had the conversation earlier on, both within the family members, the decision makers, the siblings, and of course, with the patient themselves. But of course, when someone's in a state of advanced dementia, you cannot ask them in the situation, what do they want? And so if you have the opportunity to discuss this earlier on, that in my mind is a great tova, right? Is a great favor to the patient, the family member, to the loved one, to discuss this with them beforehand. One second, there's a little problem here. I'll try to pull something up. I'm not sure I can pull this up right now. One moment. Okay. Sorry, let me just pull, I want you to see this for a minute. And this is one of those questions, which, like I said, is one of those things where it's not an easy conversation again, but it is one of those things which really, I really encourage people to try to talk to their loved ones about, at least get a feel for it. And so if you look in the Tivot, our Advanced Healthcare Directive, so we have a non-binding section. Try to get people's general preferences, try to get their general feelings. And one of the questions which we put on there is, if I have an irreversible lack of cognition, as in cases of advanced dementia or severe brain injury, I would prefer. Right? Put it out there, front and center. I know where I feel on this, but different people have different feelings on this issue, and different rabbis in your posting map have different feelings on this issue. And give us a little bit of a sense of what you want, right? And that is literally a gift to your loved ones, right? And in terms of telling them, giving them a sense of like, this is something that I want you to know how I feel about this issue. And I'll take questions momentarily, but we had a case very recently where I got consulted. It was a man who had advanced dementia, and his son called me up. And it's one of these cases where you have the full variety pack, right, of children of different religious orientation, different orientation on these issues. And I asked the son who called me about the question. So I said to him, "Well, do you ever discuss this issue with your father?" And he said, "Well, no, we never properly discussed it, but there is one thing he did say to us very clearly." His mother had also died after a prolonged case of Alzheimer's, and he had said to them, "Don't let me become like mom." That was very, very important to him. Okay, now it would be better if it had been spelled out a little bit more, but it was very helpful to him. And there is a certain crossroads of a question about certain interventions at that moment, and they asked me what I felt, and I felt that this was indicative of his larger feeling on the issue. But given the circumstances, whatever it was, I didn't want to answer myself. I knew the family members needed someone else to answer this, and it went to Rav Asher Weiss, a great posting in Yerushalayim. And the Rav Asher's first question to them was, "Did your father express to you at any point his feelings on this issue?" Okay, and that's why I'm telling you it is so important to have these conversations, right? And to be able to talk about these things. Okay, I'll stop here and let's take some questions. Let me just look out. There are a few things that came up. Oh, already on the, I have mail follow as well. With regard to Susanna points out feeding tubes cause suffering and have been shown to hasten death. Yeah, no, feeding tubes are not the are not a be all and end all by any means of extending people's lives and doing good things for people. It happens to be my own father, Zichrono Levracha, died after infection of having a peg inserted into him. So I'm well aware of the dangers of those interventions. Yeah, feeding tubes are not perfect solutions by any means. Feeding tubes were not created, like many, many medical interventions we use, were not created to be long-term solutions. They're meant to be bridges, right? Bridges to somewhere until some people get better in other ways. And so, yes, feeding tubes have all sorts of complications. Len points out here. Yeah. Right, no, yes, I'm not, yes, I fully understand, but you should understand that feeding tubes sometimes work out well, right? And so this is a question that's going to have to be felt out on this issue and when you feel it out. Lisa, I can't read your whole thing here, so why don't I just, let me see if I can unmute here and bring you into the conversation. Of course, I'll take more conversations as we go along. Hold on one second, Lisa. Lisa, I'm trying to unmute you. You have to unmute.
Okay. I mean, I think your point about following someone's wishes that were established before is really important. And I also think there's a very large misunderstanding about what is really going on in late stage dementia. And that, first of all, the dementia state, even as it changed, even as it begins, it changes every hour. It changes every 15 minutes. It's never static. So if you're looking at a person, and I think that the outside person who doesn't have dementia looks at this person, they're no longer who they are. And that's not true. The only thing that's the issue is there's not sufficient neurons in the brain, and so they can't form new memories. And there's a confused state. But usually, I'm going to call them the foundational memory is still there. And there's also people who are intelligent, even in end-stage dementia, they still will know things. That it's a protection. I would just be very, very careful about trying to judge someone's state as an outsider to what that person is experiencing.
It's a great point, and this is part of what pushes Rav Steinberg on this issue, where Professor Steinberg feels very strongly that, partly but based on what you're saying right now, is that, you might think that they're suffering, and this is terrible, but it's right, not necessarily true, right? And so that is part of what pushes him along this direction. He feels very, very strongly. And sort of in the spirit of what you're saying, and there's a consequence to that. Now, the consequence to that is that we wouldn't, and we should keep on maintaining life-sustaining interventions. Now, Rav Schechter of Willigs is partly on a feeling of this suffering, but it's also partly on, and this is the other piece of this, of a sense that there's a greater room for autonomy to say that I might not be suffering, but I don't want to be living in that condition. I don't want to be in that circumstance. And therefore, I would be willing to withhold treatment interventions in those that circumstance. So it's sort of two parts to it, and it's not contingent there on suffering per se, right? And of course, it's hard to say for a person to say in advance what they're going to think at this moment they haven't experienced it, and where we have such little understanding of what's actually going on in the minds of people in different period stages and fluxes of dementia. So that is why this is such a difficult issue on so many levels, right? I appreciate the point that you're making here. And this is a really, really live debate. I myself have very mixed feelings on this whole issue on an ethical level. I don't have much to contribute on the medical part, but on the ethical level, I have a lot of mixed feelings on it, which is why I do think it's important for people to express a bit of their own feelings on it, because I think there's room to respect personal preferences on this issue. Rivka asks, what do those who oppose withdrawing care in severe dementia think about hospice care, since active treatment is withheld in that setting? So, people, it depends on the circumstance. Hospice care is dedicated to people who have a prognosis of living 6 months or less. That's not necessarily the case when it comes to dementia or Alzheimer's, and so they're not necessarily going to be in hospice. And frequently they might be in hospice, but in those circumstances, in general, it depends on the type of what care. Like I was saying beforehand, the biggest thing that we worry about withdrawing are things that will directly hasten someone's death, which isn't always the case, like a ventilator. But in many of these cases, we're not talking about ventilators here. So if there's some other comorbidity along with Alzheimer's and the person's in hospice care, it can be very appropriate. I always try to emphasize this. Hospice can keep people alive a lot longer than, active interventions. And the world is seeing that right now with the Carters, with Jimmy Carter and Rosalind Carter, right? I mean, they've graduated their first round of hospice, which is an important sign for people. Suri, your question. Oh, I need to unmute you. 1 second. I forgot it.
Okay. In terms of hospice, the way it's been explained to me is that hospice does comfort care as opposed to curative care. But I think that it gets fuzzy. For example, you mentioned pneumonia. So if you say it's just comfort care, then maybe you give the person pain medicine, but you don't actually treat the pneumonia with, let's say, antibiotics. But pneumonia is the kind of thing where if it's untreated, it makes the person uncomfortable. And
Right.
so the line between comfort care and curative care is very blurred.
Yes, very blurred.
The sensation of drowning in your own fluid in your lungs has got to be, you know, painful.
That's the worst.
Uncomfortable.
No, 100%. And so these are always going to be difficult determinations of where you draw those lines. And again, this is partly pushing, particularly in these cases, why Professor Steinberg is very adamant on this issue, because he doesn't feel this falls into the same category as ALS or cancer or some other type of situations. And because also he feels that there are times when people can be much more cognizant than we necessarily recognize, and that they can't express that. And so we wanted error here, not just error, but being assuming that we're doing things to address their pain and manage their comfort in a very significant way. A very difficult dilemma. These are very, very difficult dilemmas. This, like I was saying to you, is really a live debate, and is difficult on this. How is an ICD viewed as recurring intervention? Richard, I don't know if you're still on, Richard. You want to ask the question?
Sorry, this is a technical, personal. This is an implanted cardio defibrillator, which was listed on the list on the list on the screen of recurring intervention.
Not recurring, of cyclical.
Cyclical, that you can, there'll be stopping points. That's a very strange, I don't understand. I have one. And the only time, you know, in 10 years, they'll replace the batteries or something, but is that what it means?
No, what Rush or Vice is referring to on this is when people have this, yeah, and there is something towards the end of, it's a good question, but, and there's a fear for various reasons that they're nearing the end of life. You don't want to have that on, and it will cause defibrillation in cases where it might be quite painful. And so you can opt there to turn it off in that situation. That's what it's referring to there. By the default, of course, it's constantly in use, right? Constantly available.
Right. It's on all the time. And the only way to take it out is to stop it is by.
Well, you see, that's an interesting question, though, because it's true that it is on all the time, but it's not doing anything per se all the time. Right. It's available. So he feels that makes it intermittent. Right? The fact that it's available, but not necessarily, yes, no, right? Not necessarily activated, right, is significant here. And in his mind, that allows it to be inactivated.
Oh, but at least in my case, it also functions as a pacemaker. And it's it is working. It doesn't do the defibrillation all the time, but it does the other things, you know, several times a minute.
Right. Okay. Every case is going to be a little bit different here in terms of this, but his feeling, though, actually on this is that those can be inactivated, right? And uh-huh. Both actions can be deactivated, right? That's how it functions. Pacemaker part of it as well. And so, again, every case is going to be different, but we're dealing here with situations where you don't actually want. Right. If you have a situation where you're at the point of allowing natural death and not doing interventions, you do not want the defibrillator going off, right? And active in those moments.
Right.
So that's referring to it. And once again, the line sometimes of discerning, delineating what is intermittent and what is continuous can be tricky. And his feeling here, which I agree with, is that that can be deactivated. Rivka, was that hand? No, okay. So I don't know if there's anything else here. Dina said yes. I think I mentioned that there as well. Okay. Oh, Jolaine.
Okay. I just have a comment to make.
Go ahead.
Noticed a significant decline over the past 2 months and felt it was a natural consequence of her aging process. I took her to her physician and reviewed her medications. The doctor realized that it is very likely my mother's problems over this past 2 months was due to the medications. So, and that my mother can be much better than what she was. So, but the point I'm bringing this up, it would have been so easy to have assumed her confusion and the increased dementia was due to brain and not due to medications. Thanks.
Medications. What caused, I mean, that is a major issue in general, right? Medications can cause all sorts of things that people think, oh, it's X, Y, and Z, and it's just side effects and whatnot. That's a major issue. Always good to keep in mind as well. Yes. Okay, I'll stick around if there are any other questions. But like I said, you know, the goal here was to try to give a general sense of some of the issues here. I hope this is helpful for many of you who are thinking about this on a practical level, let alone the theoretical knowledge from this case. And feel free, of course, as always, to reach out if I can be of assistance.
Rabbi Brody?
Yes, go ahead, sir.
I just wanted to pick up on what the previous speaker was saying, that sometimes medications can completely throw you off and the presentation looks like dementia, but it's not. And that is also true of certain medical conditions. A bad UTI can make a person look like they have dementia. A drop in sodium below the normal range can manifest itself as dementia. The person becomes somewhat non-communicative, non-responsive. So it's always important to check for other causes before you assume that it's dementia.
Yes, someone else is even writing in the chat as well about UTIs. And these are difficult situations on a medical level, let alone ethical here. And of course, always have to rule out, you know, figure out what exactly is going on. But thank you for that point, because it's important for people to recognize it.
Thank you. It was very, very informative.
Oh, thank you so much. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Stay safe.
Thank you.